The data prior to the pandemic did not reflect an education system that was on the right track. The pandemic simply made it worse.
Can kids catch up after a massive pandemic learning loss? It's Monday, October 24th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Later in the show, we'll look back on what the Cuban Missile Crisis could tell us about today's nuclear anxiety and hear how one NASA scientist hopes to overcome discrimination in her field and one day go to space. But first, the Department of Education is out with what it calls the nation's report card, and it's not good. That was Education Secretary Miguel Cardona we heard a moment ago. He called the situation heartbreaking and horrible. Let's dig into the data a bit with Peggy Carr. She's head of the National Center for Education Statistics, which issued the report card. She spoke to Deepa Fernandez.
So the survey centers on just fourth and eighth graders, and it offers a snapshot from before and after the pandemic in math and reading levels. Now, a lot of people would probably expect a drop because of the interruptions from COVID, but you found an historic fall-off in math scores. Tell us more about that.
Yes, we have been collecting these data since the 1990s, and we would typically see a change of 1 or 2 points across that time period. So an 8-point drop in mathematics is historic.
And we're talking here about a very broad drop across all parts of the country from students of all achievement levels across racial and ethnic groups. What does that tell you?
Well, that it was systemic. We had no student group to show an improvement in mathematics whatsoever. In fact, the gap between students widened during this time period, with Black and brown students showing stronger declines than their white counterparts, although they showed declines as well. It was systemic and it affected all students.
I just want to give our listeners a very quick sense of what you might have been asking. So like at the eighth grade level, you know, it's something like converting miles to yards, right? And that was something that children struggled with.
Yes, they did. We have algebraic equations that we would expect an eighth grader to be able to answer. When you compare the 1990 cohort of students to the 2022, you see a drop of 8 points or so. It means more students are in that below basic range where they're not even exhibiting partial mastery of fundamental skills.
And reading as well showed broad declines. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the reading did show declines, 3 points for fourth and eighth grade. 3 points is not clearly as concerning as the 8-point drop that we saw in mathematics, but statistically concerning nonetheless. And when you look at the declines across the states and jurisdictions, sometimes you'll see even double-digit declines in reading.
So we know that students with disabilities suffered tremendously during the pandemic, and we're not talking about a small number of students here. Some people may not realize we're talking about 1 in 7 students having a disability. But what does the data show for them?
Well, students with disabilities are scoring lower, as they typically do. But in some cases, in reading, for example, they were able to hold their own. We think it's because schools prioritize getting them back in school faster than they did, you know, with non-students with disabilities.
Well, did your report find a cause for this drop? Was it remote learning?
The remote learning question is not a simple one because you can't draw a line from remote learning per se in and of itself to these declines that we're seeing, because the spread, the decline across the country was systemic. Almost everyone declined. We're going to do some more digging. We're going to commission some studies to see if we can ferret out exactly what contribution remote learning had. But there were so many other disruptions that it's difficult to say it was because of remote learning. Students are having mental health issues, for example. Students are more disruptive. more bullying is occurring. There's so many factors. The whole child needs to be part of this remedy here.
Dr. Peggy Carr heads the National Center for Education Statistics, which today released the nation's report card. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up,
our goal is not the victory of might, but the vindication of right.
Reflecting on the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's after the break. 60 years ago, the world was on the brink of nuclear Armageddon.
We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced.
President John F. Kennedy gave his Cuban Missile Crisis address on October 22, 1962. Today, the war in Ukraine has again raised the specter of nuclear war, so we called up Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh to help put that history in context. Jim is a senior research associate at MIT's Security Studies Program, and he spoke to Celeste Headley.
Good to be with you, Celeste.
It's good to have you. So let's start in the present day. Russia has claimed that Ukraine plans to use a dirty bomb that would be explosives that are laced with radioactive material. Kyiv disputes this. Where do these allegations come from? Why make this specific claim, and what might they tell us about Russia's plans?
So first, you always have to remind yourself in a war, a big war, the countries will do desperate or ugly things, especially if it's a fight for survival. So could Ukraine do something like this? Yes. But is this it? Are they're planning a dirty bomb? No, not at all. As you said, a dirty bomb is just a regular explosive with some radioactive junk. It doesn't actually kill any more people than the bomb itself. The radiation is just to scare people, and that's why they actually are rarely used or even threatened to be used in modern warfare. But it might be useful if you wanted to stage an event that then you could use as a pretext for escalation. And I think that's what analysts are wondering about. Is Russia sort of floating this out because it plans to do it, and then to have a dirty bomb then be used to justify its own escalation? Now, the problem is we're at the point in the war where it's hard to tell when Russia is just sort of lying and bluffing or lying because it wants to set something up it plans to do in the future. And I think at this point, we just don't know.
I mean, since you're talking about escalation, let's go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. That was probably the most tense moment of the Cold War. How did that escalate and then eventually de-escalate?
Yeah, well, the U.S. had previously put nuclear missiles in Italy and Turkey near Russia, or at least that's the way Russia saw it. And Cuba, which had been the subject of the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, was asking Russia for support. Now, I think the Soviets underestimated the degree to which the U.S. was going to freak out over this. They were no doubt surprised to learn that the generals were advising Kennedy to launch a military strike and invasion of Cuba. And I'm pretty sure the generals were surprised to find out later that the Russians or the Soviets had already transferred tactical nuclear weapons to the island, which they would have used. Now, it was all resolved through diplomacy, not threats, not bluster, but more of a, if you do this, I'll do that, and we'll both be safer.
So let's fast forward back to today's tension, and we're hearing rhetoric from the Kremlin where they're threatening to use nuclear weapons because of the conflict in Ukraine. Does that make you hear echoes of the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Sure. I mean, in some ways, the danger never went away. Perhaps the most important and underappreciated piece of the Cuban Missile Crisis is that Kennedy and Khrushchev scared to death at a moment when citizens in the U.S. and in different parts of the globe were had previously been protesting nuclear testing. They moved to do something about it. And so for the first time in 1963, a month before JFK is assassinated, we have the Partial Test Ban Treaty. And from there, we get other things. The Non-Proliferation Treaty, bilateral agreements. We went from 80,000 nuclear weapons, we cut them by 50,000, dismantling them. And so it was an important period, and then the Cold War ended, and we just sort of walked away from all that success, and now a slow building, more tests, bigger stockpiles, countries pulling out of agreements, which has brought us to today. So are there lessons from the past that apply? Absolutely. But we sort of forgot those after the Cold War, and now we're facing a resumed new danger.
Okay, so then on the other side of the world, North Korea is testing more weapons and regularly firing in the proximity of South Korea and Japan. How concerning are those tests?
Well, I expect them to test. I think they'll conduct at least one, probably more nuclear tests by the end of the year. They said they're going to do it. They've been saying they're going to do it. Relations continue to be poor. I think what's held them back is COVID and sensitivity to the Chinese. But I fully expect them to test, and I expect that to add to the uncertainty and anxiety on top of what we already have.
Okay, so we have less than a minute here, Jim, but what would you tell world leaders they should have learned from the Cuban Missile Crisis 60 years ago that they haven't?
Well, I would tell them, you don't know as much as you think you do. You're making a lot of assumptions, and if those turn out to be wrong, we could have an extinction event. So caution, not hubris, is the word. And then I would say, don't be led astray. There are lessons learned, but don't be led astray. One of the things that the U.S.-Soviet rivalry reinforced, that the Cuban Missile Crisis reinforced, was the feeling that it was all about us. You know, there wasn't going to be a nuclear problem unless we were involved. And as long as we were involved, you know, it was going to turn out okay.
Yeah.
Now we're finding out that's not true. We could have a nuclear war between two countries 50 years from now. The U.S. would not be involved, and yet we could all die. Between a war of two other countries. So,
MIT's Ed Jim Walsh, he's also here now as resident security analyst. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, it's Black in Physics Week, and we've got a chat with one NASA scientist trying to change her field for the better. Stick around. The sky is not the limit for K. Renee Horton. She's a past president of the National Society of Black Physicists and now works for NASA. Black women are often overlooked in many fields, and Horton also has a disability that at first glance isn't obvious, hearing loss. Her experiences have inspired her to advocate for people with disabilities in physics, and she has her own dream of going to space. In December, she'll be one step closer to that goal when she goes on her first zero-gravity flight. She told Deepa her love for science started early in life.
I always love this question because it's always those parents who do those things for kids and not knowing that it'll make an impact on the rest of their lives. And so at 9, my dad and my mom got me a telescope. I had been wanting one, and so it was my Christmas gift that year.
And that obviously inspired what became a very successful career in physics. But I think we should tell our listeners that you're one of very few Black women at the highest levels of physics. I want to ask you why you think that is, and also, what has that felt like as you've made your way upwards in the field?
You know, physics is a white male-dominated field. We used to always say, you know, we're never going to be a part of the good old boys club, because that club is truly, you know, in a place where we stand out, one as women, but then again as Blacks. And for me, there's an organization called the National Society of Black Physicists, and I had the honor of serving as its president. And during that time, it made me realize that I belong in that area. I had a talent and I have something to contribute. And when we're dealing with all the other things that go along with why people don't survive in an area, right, or survive in a particular field, standing as the president made me realize that all the fighting I was doing was worth it. It was worth being there and being able to bring my talent there as well.
Tell us about some of those other things, some of the discrimination, the hurdles that you had to overcome.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned the elephant in the room, the discriminations. Believe it or not, that it's a field with a lot of discriminations. There are a lot of people who still feel that it is the elite of the elite as far as science is concerned. And for them, it's really hard to think of people that were originally enslaved being able to be in a field that is the elite of the elite. And so being able to matriculate through this field over the last 10 or 12 years, I've just really come into some serious hurdles along the way. It's like they're willing to play dirty sometimes, because I could have the best science in the world or able to communicate it or able to be able to do it. but yet and still you want to bring up my private life or my personal life or things like that, right? Mm. I was a non-traditional student, so I actually started college at 16, found out about my hearing disability between 17 and 18, and then I got pregnant, dropped out of school, traveled with my husband at the time, following his career, and then I came back to school after 10 years. Well, one of the things I would often hear my male colleagues say was, you know, women belong at home with their children, because I had small children at the time. Mm. And so just dealing with those type of discriminations and then learning how to balance your work-life balance, your load, being able to give your family what they need while pursuing your career, and also keeping your family separate from your career, because men are able to do that as well.
Renee, you mentioned a moment ago hearing loss, and that was something that you discovered, you said, around age 17. So if you could just tell us, how severe is your hearing loss?
So I have moderate to severe hearing loss in both ears. So I always tell people it's bilateral. So I wear hearing aids on both sides. Originally, I had some of my lows and then some of my highs. Ironically, I still hear birds naturally without hearing aids. But I had lost the section of my hearing, which is in the speech range. So for those who speak English as a second language, my brain does not always compute with an accent what is actually being said, and I don't hear those words clearly. Over time, my hearing has degraded, and now I've lost some of the lows as well.
What has that loss, hearing loss, meant for your life?
Oh, gosh. At the time my hearing loss was discovered, it was a game changer for my life. I had gone in to do my Air Force ROTC physical to pursue a career as a pilot and then go on and apply for the astronaut corps. That was my big dream, right? And then when I found out I was hearing impaired and I did not qualify for the Air Force as an officer, it really shook me to my core because I didn't know at that time what else I wanted or how else to pursue anything. I felt as if I was a defect and a reject at that moment. And when I got pregnant, it was like I was okay with being a mom and following my husband's career at the time. And then we separated 7 years later. And at that time, I realized there was so much more that I really could achieve.
What was the turning point? Because that trajectory would have derailed so many of us. Yet something obviously turned you around to retake some agency and to say, no, I want to go forth.
I had given birth to my daughter the year before I decided to go back to college. And constantly looking at her and knowing I wanted the world to be different for her. So I decided to go back to undergrad and finished undergrad in 2 years and then went on to get my PhD.
You know, I want to look ahead because that little nine-year-old's dream when she looked through the telescope of going to space might actually not be so far-fetched, right? Because, you know, the flight that you're taking, it seems like you are headed to space. Well, not quite. You're going on a special airplane flight that flies within the Earth's atmosphere in a way that allows you to experience zero gravity similar to the training that astronauts go through. And you're doing this flight with other people with disabilities through a nonprofit group called Astro Access. And that's going to be in December. Is this as close as you can get to space? Just lay out what the flight is for us.
So for me, this will give me the experience of what weightlessness feels like. And so it's just like being in space, even though we will not be in space. But this also could lead to bigger things. I'm super, super excited about that. It never even crossed my mind that this was something I could do. And one of my fellow flyers last year contacted me and was like, you should apply. And I was like, yeah, I don't know about that. And he flew last year, and he's deaf. And I was thinking, whoa, maybe I shouldn't be limiting me at this point. And so this year I applied, and I was accepted as a part of a crew of 16 of us. And I'm just amazed that I'm a part of this group as well, because there are paraplegics and amputees, and there's the deaf, there's the blind, and their mission, Astro Access's mission, is to make sure that people with disabilities can be in space, that space is affordable and available to all of us through this program. And so I'm really excited about being able to be a part of it. I touch so many different success is when I look at my intersection in life. And with as many kids that I get to walk out, speak to, talk to, like being able to add this adventure and being able to talk about it later will let these kids know that no matter what, you can dream big and you can have these dreams.
Is that also why you write children's books?
I do. I write the children's books. It started off as a joke because I created the character. And then people are like, what are we doing with the character?
And the character is Dr. H. Is that you?
That is me. And she has the hearing aids just like me. And it was more or less to show people that you don't have to look or be like everyone else to still be able to do the things that you love to do. So in the book, we travel through space. And in doing that, the kids get to learn amazing facts about planets. And I absolutely love it. So when the kids see me, they go, oh, my God, you're back from space. And it's like, yes, I went in my imagination, but I went. And so they also get to understand that it's okay to be able to imagine and dream the things that you want to do, because you can either write about them as an author or you can live them as an astronaut.
Renee Horton is a scientist at NASA in New Orleans, Louisiana. Renee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Go to hereandnow.org for more stories, including the latest on Rishi Sunak's rise to prime minister in the UK. And we hear from one Afghan who fled after the Taliban takeover. He says if he returns, he'll be persecuted for his LGBTQ identity.
I don't want to go back to Afghanistan, and that's a nightmare to me.
Today's stories were produced by Shirley Jihad, Thomas Danielian, and Ashley Locke. Todd Munt and Gabe Bullard edited the show. Our technical directors are Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Mike, Max Liebman, and I wrote the theme music. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.